Good evening and welcome to our Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and Kepler's Bookstore program brought to you from Foothill College. My name is Antonia Squire, General Manager for Kepler's Books. Few events clarify the importance of independent bookstores as a platform for independent voices more than tonight's gathering. We first met Greg Mortensen back in 2006 when Three Cups of Tea was released and he was traveling around the country gathering support for his book and his cause. Kepler's committed to both. The idea that if you educate women, you promote peace and inoculate thousands against ignorant hatred is powerful. The idea that one individual can lead thousands to solve intractable problems is a given here in Silicon Valley. And so we were confident that if we provided the platform, these ideas would resonate and our community would respond. And so you have. To date, you have purchased nearly 10,000 copies of Greg Mortensen's books at Kepler's and have helped drive Three Cups of Tea onto the bestsellers list, into paperback edition, and now into a sequel. We thank you. We knew it was important for our young people to meet Greg, and so we have been to schools, theaters, gyms, churches, and of course packed the stores to the rafters several times. The Commonwealth Club also joined us by supporting a high school visit in San Jose. We are proud to be jointly hosting Greg again tonight one more time and to help him take one more step towards peace. Please welcome Greg Mortensen.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks. Well, thank you so much, and it's always great to be in the Bay Area. It's kind of one of my homes. As some of you might know, I met my wife here in 6 days and got married in the Oakland Courthouse in 95, so thank you so much. And again, I'd like to thank Kepler's Books and to Clark, the CEO, and Vivian, and Jean, and Doreen, and many of the people at Kepler's who worked so hard for many weeks to get this set up. I'd also like to thank the Commonwealth Club. I think there's about 300 people here. Who's from the Commonwealth Club? Unless it's secret. Okay. All right. There's a few of you. Okay. And Foothill College. And we also have some very special guests, the people who really helped me out in the beginning, a very long time ago. Lou Reichard, and I don't know, is Kathy here? You want to stand up? Lou Reichard, he's... Lou is... neurophysiologist at UCSF. He's the first American to climb K2, and he was actually the one, when I started out, I thought about quitting my job or quitting my attempt to build a school, and he called me up and said, you know, what you're doing is harder than climbing K2, and that was that phone call that really got me going again, so thanks, Lou. And also Nick and Betsy Clinch, you're right there, right? Nick is a dear friend, been around... Nick helped me out a lot with figuring out how to run a board and all the management problems. And Betsy was actually secretary for Barry Bishop, my father-in-law. Was that right? In National Geographic? Or assistant? Oh, you were at National Geographic. Okay. But thank you so much. And also I have many of my board directors here. There's Julia Bergman, librarian at City College, San Francisco. She's retired now. She was our previous board chair. And then very dear friends, Karen and George McCowan. Karen is on our board. You want to stand up so they know who to talk to afterwards if they can't meet me? Thank you. And last but not least, our board chairman, Dr. Abdul Jabbar, who is also at CCF, and his wife, Talat. Thank you. I'd also, what's that? Oh, Chrissy Slaughter. Chrissy Slaughter used to be our babysitter, and now she's our board director. She tells me what to do. So, Chrissy, in the back there, thank you. And also Joy Dergello, who's helped, and she's been over many, many times to Pakistan, helped with teacher training, Joy, and Bob Irwin there. And many of you have been so instrumental for 17 years. I'm just so deeply indebted to you, and our love and thanks to all of you. I'd also like to thank the librarians and the teachers and the Commonwealth Club and the military veterans and the, just all of you. Just thank you so much. Well, when I wrote Three Cups of Tea, I picked the title, and it was in honor of Haji Ali, the village chief, in a very remote area in Pakistan, who told me, if you want to do business here, you need three cups of tea. So, first of all, how many of you have read Three Cups of Tea? Okay. Forget that. I've got to tell another story here. But what you might not know is I picked the title in honor of Haji Ali, the village chief, who told me, if you want to do business, you need three cups of tea. The first cup, you're a stranger. Second cup, a friend. And third cup, you become family. But the publisher, Viking Penguin, picked the subtitle. And they said it should be one man's mission to fight terrorism one school at a time. And although I'm a military veteran, I was very opposed to that because I said the real reason I do this is to promote peace. Well, they disagreed with me. So with the blessings of my board, I went to New York. It's my first time there, and I summoned a jirga. It's like a tribal conference. These are all the chief people in Penguin Putnam, the whole publishing industry, the CEO and head of marketing and head of publicity. So I very eloquently tried to say why I want the subtitle to be one man's mission to promote peace one school at a time. Well, they disagreed with me, and they said, Greg, you need to learn a couple things about the publishing industry. Only one out of eight books makes a profit, and two-thirds of all bestsellers are pre-chosen by the publisher. So we would like to promote your book, but you must be fighting terrorism so we can pitch the media, and then your book will do just fine. Well, I finally conceded, but if you work in Pakistan or Afghanistan for a while, you learn that you never settle a deal without driving a hard bargain on the side. So I said, if the hardcover doesn't do well, please change the paperback subtitle to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time. So the hardcover came out with a fighting terrorism subtitle in March 2006. And it didn't do very well. And in January 2007, they changed the subtitle to One Man's Mission to Promote Peace One School at a Time. And now it's been a New York Times bestseller for 148 weeks in a row. You know, fighting terrorism is based in fear, but promoting peace is based in hope. And the real enemy we all face, whether it's in Afghanistan or Africa or Pakistan or America, is ignorance. And it's ignorance that breeds hatred. And to overcome ignorance, we have to have courage, we need compassion, and most of all, I think it's based in education. I've also received thousands of emails and letters from people serving in the military the last 3 or 4 years. They pretty much reiterate that without education, nothing will change. General David Petraeus sent me an email last year. He's the CENTCOM commander, and he said he had read Three Cups of Tea, and he had three important points that he had gleaned from the book that he wanted to impart with the troops. Now, being a military general, he summarized them in three bullet points. Number one, we need to listen more. Number two, we need to build respect. And number three, we must build relationships. So today, per Secretary Gates, our defense secretary, Three Cups of Tea is mandatory reading for all senior military commanders and for all special forces deploying to Afghanistan. This is General Petraeus and then Admiral Eric Olson, who's our special forces commander of the 58,000 special forces, a SOCOM commander. And this is General Conway. It's interesting. If you talk to any military general, and I'm going to kind of set this as a stage, but they will tell you there is no military solution in Afghanistan. They will tell you right to your face. They will say the solution has got to be a much broader solution, and there is no military solution in that country. And so we'll come to that in a few minutes. Well, a lot of people ask me, they don't like to talk to the military. I do it. I'm a veteran. I do it totally voluntarily. There's no compensation. I do it because I want to, help out with the troops and brief them. I visit about 24 military bases a year. And so I'm going to share with you very quickly what I share with the troops, just so you kind of know, get an idea of a feel of it. I asked my 9-year-old son to design this PowerPoint that I talked to the military about. So it's way beyond my capacity, so if something goes wrong, you know, we're going to have to just forget it. So this is a traditional power structure in the tribal areas. The E is an elder, and the M is a mullah, and the Y are the youth. And traditional society, can you stop? You know, I visit about 200 schools a year in the U.S. I go to public schools, private schools, urban schools, rural schools, elementary schools, all the way through the Air Force Academy. And one of the first question I ask students is, how many of you have talked in great detail to your grandparents or your elders about the Depression or World War II or the Vietnam War or the Civil Rights Movement? And generally, anybody want to guess what the average is in the U.S.? 10%? Somebody? 2, 5? It's actually about 10%. It goes from 5 to 20%. Now, if I ask the same exact question in Pakistan or Afghanistan, about 90 or 100% of the hands come up. And I think it's one of the tragedies of our country that we've lost a tradition where we can learn from our elders. And it's about our heritage, our folklore, our culture, and our traditions. And that's one thing we do in our schools. We have the elders come in 2 or 3 times a week and do the storytelling tradition because we don't want that vital piece lost in society. It's another thing, too, that the Taliban are doing very deliberately to drive a wedge through society by destroying the relationship between the elders and the second generation, the youth. So we'll get back to the military thing now. You'll see over time now, this is a traditional society. It's based on this relationship. And then you have a very loose kind of central government on the outside. And then external forces starting affecting this structure. There's the communist government and Najibullah, Soviet invasion in 79, the warlord area from 94, and then the jihad era. Taliban come in 2004, 2006, and over time, that disintegrates the government. And fighters come in, and then you'll see how the youth start to adhere to the fighters. F will be a... Now, this is done by a 9-year-old, by the way. Does this make sense to you? Usually I take half an hour to describe this, but... So these are the fighters, and then you'll see a MR, a radical mullah, and you'll see how the youth start to associate with the fighters and the radical mullahs. And then money will start to come in, and later on you'll see the Afghan-Pakistan border here and foreign funding come in, and then you have a totally disintegrated, disrupted tribal society that's been there for about 2,000 years. And a lot of imperative to that is this relationship between the elders and the youth. Does this make sense? Okay, good. When a kid does it, it always makes sense, right? Lou, do you do this kind of stuff at university? No? Okay. So then the question is, you know, how can we help the people if there's any way to help them at all? So I think, and what I'll share with you is I think it's really based in education. I'm going to briefly just go over 3 cups of tea. I grew up in Africa. I went over there when I was 3 months old. I spent 15 years there. My father, my parents were both educators in a girls' school. And subsequently, my father decided to start a hospital called the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center. And he worked very hard to get the hospital set up. But one thing he always insisted on was having local Africans run the hospital. And that didn't go over very well with the Americans and Europeans. They said, you need a qualified Westerner to run the hospital. But my father insisted that an African be in charge. And finally, in 1971, the hospital opened up. And my father got up and gave a little speech. And he said that in 10 years, I have a prediction to make that every director of every department will be from Tanzania. And basically, he got laid off for having the audacity to believe and say that this hospital would be run by Tanzanians. So we came back to the States, and unfortunately, my father died from cancer in 1980, in his late 40s. But we got the annual report 10 years later, and all the department heads were from Tanzania. And even today, 38 years later, all the department heads of the KCMC hospital are from Tanzania. And the important lesson there is that people can be empowered, and that we have to have the confidence and the courage and faith, and also sometimes it's a risk, but if anything is going to come out, you know, so the people control the society, it's definitely got to be to empower people. So I learned a proverb in Africa. Hopefully all of you are literate, but if you're not, I'll tell you this proverb. It says, if we educate a boy, we educate an individual, but if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. So how do the gentlemen feel about that? How do the women feel about it? Okay. Gentlemen, I think we're a little bit outnumbered here. When I was 15, I came back to the States. I wanted to play football and have 4th of July's and fireworks. But my first day in high school, St. Paul, Minnesota, I got beat up. The kids put a garbage can over my head and they started beating on me. It was because they made a mistake. I said I'm African, and there was a lot of confusion about that. But you know what? Actually, do you see this car down here? Anybody see this car? Okay, does anybody have a current photo of St. Paul Central High School? My son found this on the internet. But when I got beat up, it was actually the first time I learned what the word racism meant. And it wasn't in Africa, it was here in the U.S. We were very poor, so 4 days after high school, in June of 75, I did something very unpopular at the time, right after the Vietnam War, I joined the U.S. military. And I did it for two reasons. Number one, I wanted to serve my country, and number two, I wanted to get the GI Bill. It was actually in the military where I met young men and women from all across the U.S. and made me appreciate that this is a great country, not because of our commonality, but because of our great diversity. This is my younger sister, Krista, who really was the impetus to get me to K2. She had severe epilepsy, and in 92, she saw the baseball movie called Field of Dreams. So for her 23rd birthday in 1992, she was going to go from the Twin Cities down to Dyersville, Iowa, to see where the movie was filmed. Well, she packed her bags. When my mother went to wake up Krista July 24th, 92, Krista died in her sleep from a massive seizure. And it was very devastating. So at the time, I was a nurse. I was also in grad school, and I wanted to I was climbing a bit, so I decided to climb K2 and put an amber necklace on top of the mountain to honor my sister Krista. So finally, a year later, I went to Pakistan in 93 to K2. Lou, what year were you at? What year did you climb? 78, okay. 15 years after Lou. This is the Karakoram mountain range. In ancient Turkish, it means black rubble. And this is the greatest consolidation of high peaks in the world. There are 64 peaks above 23,000 feet high in a 100-mile area. Now, next time you go down I-5, you know, clock yourself 5 miles and pretend you're going straight up, and that's how high these peaks are. Well, I was in Boston last week, and people reminded me afterwards that in Boston, all the freeways go in circles, so it doesn't work in Boston. Anyways, this is K2. 84 Matterhorns can be put inside of K2 to fill it up. The first attempt was actually 100 years ago. The Duke of Abruzzi, an Italian gentleman, he reached about halfway up on the right-hand side. And being a gentleman, he wore hobnail boots. And being a gentleman, he wore a tweed jacket and a tie, eating cans of sardines as he went up the mountain. This is an avalanche. Just to give you a size of the scale of this, you can see four little blue tents here. If you look in a magnifying glass, you can see four Spanish men in their underwear from Terrassa, Spain, running out of their tents here. Unfortunately, nobody got killed in the avalanche. This is going up the West Ridge, and on the left-hand side is China. On the right-hand side is Pakistan. Well, finally, 78 days later, it was time to go home. And I didn't quite make it to the summit. My two partners did, but I was very disappointed because I felt as if I let my sister down. Anybody here with red three cups of tea except you in the front row here, you two. Can anybody remember what the first chapter is called in Three Cups of Tea? Failure. Very good. Give her a big round. All right. The other day there was 5,000 people and nobody remembered the first chapter. When I sent the original manuscript to Manhattan, they said, Greg, in the U.S. you never start a book with the word failure. But you know what? We all make mistakes in our lives and we all fail. Some of us fail to get tenured. Some of us fail in our relationships. Some of us burn cookies in the oven. I was on Wall Street in, was that March? And I mentioned that some of us fail in our investments, and nobody laughed there. Anyways, next time you fail, think of this very beautiful Persian proverb: when it is dark, you can see the stars. So here we are leaving K2. It's about 58 miles. I was carrying 90 pounds. I was very weak. And I took a wrong turn. I stumbled into a little village called Corfe. When I got there, the village chief, Haji Ali, first he greeted me in a very beautiful Islamic salutation, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you. And you can see him on the left with a silver beard. And then he shook his head, and he said, Chizale. Now, being from the Midwest, the best translation I can think of the word Chizale is what the heck. You know, I was weather-beaten, my pants are ripped, and I hadn't even taken a bath in 84 days. He said, before you come to my village, you do need to wash up a little bit. So anyways, I've now spent 17 years working in rural Afghanistan and Pakistan, and I've learned many things. One out of three children born dies before the age of one. The maternal mortality rate is staggering. It's, you know, it's about 100 times what it is in the U.S. About half the men leave the villages to get jobs, but who's left behind? It's the women. And the women tell me now their workload has doubled in the last 2-3 decades. Well, I spent some time recovering there. Just incredible. These are very impoverished people, incredible hospitality. One day I walked behind the village. There were 84 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons. And although I'd seen a lot of poverty in Africa, when I saw those kids, I really was touched. And as I looked around, there was no teacher there. Now, can you imagine in the U.S., no teacher in the classroom? It was because they can't afford his daily $1 salary. So Master Hussein, Master means teacher, was in the next village, Munjung, because they split his time with another school. So when a young girl named Chocho asked me to build a school, I made a promise that day and said, I promise I'll build a school for you. You know, today we are trying to grapple or solve something called poverty. And the only way I think that we can solve poverty is that we have to touch poverty, and we have to smell poverty, and we have to taste poverty, and we have to hear poverty, and we have to be with poverty. We can never solve poverty from a think tank in Washington, D.C. And to me, what is so inspiring, there's kind of a phenomenon going around this country, and many of you are familiar with that. But if you visit high schools and junior highs and even elementary schools or other places, there's this phenomenon called community service or service learning or civic engagement. There was a U.S. News and World Report that came out 3 years ago. It said that in 1970, 30% of college graduates said, I want to go out and make my community or my nation or the world a better place. By 1990, it dropped to 18%. That was the day everybody wanted to go out and make a buck, you know, the me generation. Today, 50% of college graduates say, I want to go out and make my community or country or the world a better place. And if you go down to high schools, it's even higher than that. And the reason for that, I think, is just simply the community service that kids are involved in. You know, very simple things, picking up garbage, washing dishes in a soup line, helping a younger child learn how to read and write, or maybe, you know, just all kinds of little things. But those are very, they're very important catalysts that really get kids to think about helping others. The problem is, though, with many kids, though, is they don't know exactly what to do or how to do it, and they don't have role models. So I'll share with you in a couple minutes how the role models really helped. Well, I came back to the States. I was totally broke, and I had to raise $12,000. I had no clue how to fundraise. I got a lot of flack for that, but I came back to the Bay Area. I think I had like $40 in my pocket. So I went to the local library. The librarian and I in Berkeley looked up the name of 500 celebrities and movie stars. At the time, I was computer illiterate, so I hand-typed 508 letters. Dear Michael Jordan. Dear Sylvester Stallone. Anyways, guess what happened? Nothing happened. Then at Christmas time, I got one check back from Tom Brokaw. Now, Tom has recently moved to Montana, and he's been incredible support with 3 Cups of Tea, but he's also kind of avoiding me lately. We've been over to his ranch for dinner a couple times, and so I asked Tom, why are you avoiding me lately? He said, well, Greg, I'm kind of embarrassed because everywhere I go in airports and other places, people pull me aside and ask about this 3 Cups of Tea thing. And I wrote you a $100 check, and you wrote about it and stuck it in the book. Now, I didn't quite have the guts to say, you know, Tom, you could still write another check, and we'll stick it in the next book. But anyways, thank you, Tom. And to add some insult to that, my daughter Mira, who's now 13, we were doing homework the other night. She was a little bit distracted, and she looked up at me and said, "Daddy, I figured out that in 1993, you spent $128 on postage, and you only raised $100. That's what education does for you." Anyways, then I sold my car. I had my grandpa's old Buick. I sold my climbing gear, and I went to Black Oak Bookstore in Berkeley. I sold all my books, and, you know, it's very painful. I love books, just like Nick. Nick's a aficionado for books. Can you imagine selling all your books at 90% off? Okay. Anyways, so I'd raised $3,000, and my mother, who's a principal in Wisconsin Elementary School, invited me to come and talk to school. And it was the first time I'd spoken to anybody, you know, adults or kids, about what I was doing. And, you know, heaven forbid you go to elementary school to raise money. When I got ready to leave West Side School, a fourth grader named Jeffrey came up to me. He looked at me deadpan and said, "I have a piggy bank at home and I'm going to help you." And I didn't think anything of it. And 6 weeks later, West Side School raised 62,340 pennies. And when you think about it, it wasn't celebrities, it wasn't adults, it was children who reached out to children halfway around the world, and they did it with pennies. Last year, I spent a couple days at SDSU, San Diego, and an economist who studies pennies down there, I don't know why, but he studies pennies a lot, he told me there are enough pennies in the U.S., we could do one of two things. We could double our national public education budget for 1 year just with pennies. If you plan to do that locally in the Bay Area, please do not send your money to D.C. You know, keep it locally. And number two, we could eradicate global illiteracy. There are 120 million children in the world today who can't go to school because of slavery and poverty, religious extremism, gender discrimination, and 78 million are female. And if we wanted to, the global community, we could eradicate illiteracy. It would cost, or, you know, nowadays I guess you say bailout, $6 billion a year for 15 years, we could eradicate global literacy. And then in August, just before I went back to Pakistan, I got a phone call from a very cantankerous Swiss physicist who lived right near here. His name was Jean Hernie. Jean had been in the area, in the Karakoram, and he called me up, and I can't do the Swiss-French accent, but he basically said, "You know, what the heck are you doing working in Pakistan and trying to help Muslims?" And I said, "Well, I got to get the school built." He said, "If I write you a check, will you promise to build a school?" And I said, "Of course I will." So anyways, with Jean's help, then I went to Pakistan in 1994 and started on the school. So now we have this program called Pennies for Peace, and for lack of better words, it's kind of going bananas lately. Last year was in 278 schools. This year it's in 4,500 schools. And when I go to I visit business schools and university, and they ask me, please explain and talk to us about your marketing plan. I said, "We don't have any. It's just run by kids." But we work with the NEA, so it's now been approved by the National Education Association with a rubric standardized system, so it can be integrated into curriculum in elementary and junior high and high school. It's been a huge help. But some things we do in the curriculum are we encourage kids to spend time with their elders. We also teach kids about philanthropic work. And most of all, we want kids to take charge and do things on their own. And that's been the most exciting things about Pennies for Peace. This young man, his name is Zach. And Zach is from Tampa, Florida. He started Pennies for Peace 3 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago. And 3 years ago, what bothered Zach is he saw homeless kids in the Bay Area. He was also bothered by the fact that his best friend had trouble learning how to read and write, and kids used to taunt his friend. So he started a foundation called Little Red Wagon Foundation. This year, Zach walked from Tampa, Florida with his Little Red Wagon. He raised $78,000 to bring awareness to homeless kids in the U.S. Next summer, I'd like you to tune in to the Little Red Wagon Foundation. He's got a little beautiful website. Did I mention he's 11? Did I tell you that? He's 11 years old now. So he's going to walk from Tampa to L.A. He's going to raise $1 million to bring awareness to homeless kids in the U.S. Well, when Zach set up his nonprofit, he called me up and asked me about board directors. You know, is it like a board person? Or I said, no, it's a moral compass and fiduciary responsibility. And Zach said, could I put some kids on my board? And I said, Zach, I don't think there's any law against it in Florida. So today, with the exception of one CPA, all of Zach's board directors have to be under 18 years of age to be on Little Red Wagon Foundation board. This is Anna Dodson. She's an orphan. She came from Peru when she was 3 to Colorado. She's 16 years old. She did Pennies for Peace for 3 years, but 2 years ago, she started thinking about her fellow orphans in Peru. So she started an organization called Peruvian Hearts with her high school classmates, and she and her high school classmates, without any adult help, are running an orphanage for 120 kids in the highlands of Peru. This young man, his name is Garrett Weiss. He's from Danville, California. It's over in the East Bay. He did Pennies for Peace for 3 years, but 2 years ago, in Johannesburg, he went into the ghettos, and he saw kids living in cardboard boxes. And what bothered Garrett most of all is the kids had nowhere to play. So he started a foundation called fundafield.org, and last year he raised $58,000, and he got 5 soccer fields set up in the ghettos of Johannesburg. You know, I could go on all night for 4 hours telling about hundreds of kids doing these things. I just shared with you 3 examples. But to me, you know, it's just the impetus and what they do through Pennies for Peace, and it inspires them to go out and do these amazing things. And these, I specifically talked about them because these are totally run by kids. There's no adult interaction except, you know, some of our dollars. Well, anybody want to hear a love story? Okay. In 95, I was a bachelor. I was working as a trauma nurse in the Bay Area. I was going to school. I also was trying to get the school built in Pakistan. And I was at a fundraising dinner in San Francisco at the Fairmont Hotel where Sir Edmund Hillary was speaking, and I'd like to acknowledge Sir Ed, who's been a huge inspiration, and he passed away a couple years back, but he was a huge inspiration for me. Anyways, he was talking, though, and he kept on going, so I was getting a little sleepy. I went to the back, and there was a very beautiful woman in the back, and her name was Tara Bishop, and I started talking to her, and 6 days later, we got married at the Oakland Courthouse. So now we're living happily ever after in Montana with our 2 kids. Well, Tara, I think she's an angel. She's the really, you know, she's the real one that can help me do this. She also is a very practical, pragmatic woman. And 2 weeks after we got married, I was still writing fundraising letters at 2 in the morning. And Tara came up and she said, "You know, honey, what are you doing up so late?" And I said, "Well, I've got to get these letters written." And she looked over and she said, "Greg, those letters are all the same." I said, "Yes." And she said, "Have you ever heard of cut and paste?" Anyways, that night I got all the letters out the door. And it started the first of many trips. This is my daughter Mira at the Khyber Pass when she was 6 months old, and many beautiful trips to Pakistan. So this is Bach Mahler Senior Mason. We worked very hard to get this school set up. And you can see, though, 3 years later, we hadn't gotten very far. And actually, the problem wasn't me or them, it was me. And I was doing something in the U.S. you call micromanagement. I had my plumb line, receipts, and records, and I was determined, by golly, I'm going to get this school built and not lose a single dollar. Well, one day, Haji Ali came up to me. He took me aside, and he said, "Son, if you want to get something done here," first he showed me 3 cups of tea, and then he said, "You have to sit down and be quiet and let us do the work." And then he took my receipts, he took my plumb line, he took my records, and he locked them up in this earthen locker along with his holy Quran and prayer beads. And then he came back and said, "Inshallah, Allah willing, everything will be just fine. Don't you worry." Well, I was horrified. And guess what happened 6 weeks later? The school got built. Now, it's a very important lesson. People themselves need to be empowered. This is on a micro scale, but you can also apply this on a macro scale. And one of my main criticisms about the reconstruction policy in Afghanistan until a couple years ago, which was started at the Bonn Conference in December 2001, and 18 countries got together and decided how to rebuild the country. But it was set up as a centralized, deprovincialized type of system. Now, some of you here might remember something after World War II called the Marshall Plan. And I've studied it extensively. The Marshall Plan, I think, was a brilliant plan. The architects who designed it were genius. But the main component of the Marshall Plan is that it was provincialized and decentralized, especially in Italy and Japan. In Afghanistan, we completely flipped that around. And only the last couple of years have we really started to make some change on that. And that's also the basis of all our schools today. We provide skilled labor, materials, teacher training and support, but the community has to provide free land. free wood and free resources, and free or subsidized manual labor, 2,000 to 5,000 days of free manual labor if they want to get a school built. And what that does, it ensures a local buy-in. And that's another reason that none of our schools, I think, have been attacked or shut down. Well, we've had one attack, but no schools have been shut down by the Taliban. Another great organization called CARE, they do the same exact thing, and none of their schools have been destroyed by the Taliban. So the more I do this, I'm totally convinced that education has to be our top national and international priority, especially education for girls. I can tell there's a few teachers in here. And I'm especially interested. I think girls' education is particularly important. You know, we can drop bombs, we can hand out condoms, we can send in troops, we can put in electricity, we can build roads, we can stick in computers, but unless girls are educated, a society will never, never change. And so why is educating girls so important? Well, there are three academic reasons. Number one, it reduces infant mortality. Number two, it reduces population explosion. Number three, improve the quality of health and life itself. And I think number two is especially important. We have a lot of problems in the world today. We have global warming. We have environmental degradation. We have wars over oil and land and energy and water. But I think one of the main problems is there's just too many people on the planet, especially if you look in 3 to 5 generations. And the number one way to reduce population without doing anything else, nothing controversial, nothing political, is simply female literacy. And the best example is the country of Bangladesh. In 1970, the female literacy rate was less than 20%, and today it's tripled. And if you look at a population demographic curve, you can see in Bangladesh it's just reaching an apex now, 2.8 live births for female. 40 years ago, it was 8 births for female. Now, unlike Pakistan, Pakistan is the 4th fastest big growing country in the world. It's very frightening. It's going to double in population in the next 27 years. And the only thing, the female literacy rate is probably around 35 to 38%. Now, the government says it's 58, but there's some, you know, discretion over what determines what literacy is. And the only thing Pakistan has never done in its entire history is to have a national initiative to make sure that every single child, including females, has a right and privilege and opportunity to go to school. Until that happens, nothing will change in a country like Pakistan. Also, when girls learn how to read and write, they generally teach their mothers how to read and write. Boys, we don't seem to do that as much. You also see people coming out from the marketplace, the bazaar, with meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper. And then the mother very carefully unfolds a newspaper and asks her daughter to read the news to her. It's the first time that woman can get information of what's going on in the outside world around her. It's really powerful to see that. When someone goes on jihad, traditionally, they should also get permission from their mother. If they don't, it's quite shameful or disgraceful. When a woman has an education, she's much less likely to encourage her son to get into violence or into terrorism. And I saw that happen after 9/11, even today. The Taliban and other groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba or Jamaat Islamiyat, their primary recruiting grounds are illiterate, impoverished society because many and most educated women refuse to allow their sons to join the Taliban. And I've seen that, you know, I've talked to hundreds of women who've shared that with me. So now I've got some bad news, and I've got some good news. Do you want to hear the bad news first? Okay. Thanks, board chair. The bad news is that the Taliban and other groups, in the last 2.5 years, they've bombed, destroyed, or shut down, or burned over 1,000 schools in Afghanistan and over 850 schools in Pakistan. What's interesting, though, is that 90% of those schools, they are girls' schools. They're not boys' schools. So why do a group of big bad men with Kalashnikovs, you know, why do they want to destroy girls' schools and not boys' schools? Because I think their greatest fear, it's not a bullet, but it's a pen. What the Taliban fear the most is if the girl grows up, gets an education, becomes a mother, the value of education will go on in their community. Also, in the Hadith, which is a part of Islam, it says that the ink of a scholar is holier than the blood of a martyr. And that means simply that pen is more powerful than the sword. And the first word in the revelation of the Holy Quran to Muhammad the Prophet is the Arabic word Iqra. And Iqra means read. And the first two chapters implore that all people go out and seek the truth, go out into the world and seek the truth. It means go out and get an education. These come right from the words of the Holy Quran. Now here's the good news, and I'm asked this as a question. Now again, the front row, you've got to keep your hands down here. And you, Abdul, please. Abdul Saab. How many of you know the fact that in 2000, 9 years ago, there were 800,000 school children in Afghanistan, mostly boys? This was at the height of the Taliban. Today, 9 years later, there are 8.4 million children in school in Afghanistan, including 2.5 million females. This is the greatest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history. So are any of you aware of that before I told you right now? Where'd you hear about it? In a bookstore?
Books program.
Oh, in a books program for Afghanistan. Did anybody else know about this? One? Okay. One, two, three. This is good. You know, I've asked 500,000 people that in the last year, and only 50 hands have come up. Now 53. I was briefing five U.S. senators on Capitol Hill this February, and after I told them this, they were patting themselves on the back, and they're both parties. And I said, how can you take credit for something you don't even know about? Well, that's a politician for you. Now, of course, our politicians in the U.S., we deserve some credit. You know, we've tried to help out a lot. But the real reason is because of the fierce desire and tenacity from communities, especially women and mothers, to really try to get their kids to get an education. Aziza is from the tribal areas on the Pakistan-Afghan border. She's the first young woman out of 4,000 people to get an education. It was very difficult for her. The boys in elementary school, they threw stones at her. And in high school, some of the teachers refused to teach her. Anyway, she graduated in 98. And in her valley of Charpersan, before she started working there, 5 to 20 women died in childbirth every single year. 5 to 20 women out of 4,000 people in the valley. So she went to 2 years of training in Gilgit. A maternal health care training cost $800. She learned how to deliver babies and do pre- and postnatal care and immunizations. She came back in 2000. Her pay is $1.25 per day. Not one single woman has died in childbirth in the last 9 years in Charpersan Valley because of a brave young woman named Aziza. This is Admiral Mike Mullen. He's basically the boss of the military, or the chairman, joint chief of staff. He sent me an email last year, and he said, would you mind coming to the Pentagon and having a cup of tea with me and sharing some good news with me? You know, all I hear about is bad news. So I said, certainly, I'll come and meet you. So we had a cup of tea, and I shared with him some good news. When I got done, he said, how about, I'd really like to visit one of your schools. So is that okay with you? And I said, well, I got to check with the elders of the Shura there. But, if that's okay, no problem. So this year, July 14th, we're in a very remote valley in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. And over the horizon came three Black Hawk helicopters and settled down, and out jumped Admiral Mike Mullen. Now, I've met him several times, and I have tremendous respect for Admiral Mullen. He gave a speech at the American Legion National Convention in Louisville, Kentucky on August 13th this year. And these are some excerpts from the beginning of his speech. He said, historically, we, meaning the United States of America, we have been far too arrogant in the world, and we need to go out and serve with humility. The Muslim community is a subtle world we don't fully and don't always attempt to understand. Only through a shared appreciation of the people's culture, needs, and hopes for the future can we ourselves hope to supplant this extremist narrative. We cannot capture hearts and minds. We must engage them. We must listen to them, one heart, one mind at a time, over time. And this is Admiral Mike Mullen. Sofras Khan, who's we call him our most remote projects director. And this is Abdul Karimi, who is Afghanistan manager. And this is Colonel Christopher Kalenda. Now, Chris Kalenda, he's from Nebraska. He's got 4 kids. He's a history major. Is there any history majors in here? Good, I love history. Thank you. He's also serving in the U.S. military. And for 16 months until last August, he was a commander of the forward operating base in Nari in Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan. This is one of the most difficult, dangerous posts to serve in Afghanistan. Several of his men were killed in firefights with the Taliban last summer. He sent me an email 2 years ago. We've been in touch ever since then, and he's also now General McChrystal, who's our senior commander in Afghanistan. He's his chief advisor. And this is what he said in his email 2 years ago. I am convinced the long-term solution to terrorism is education. This is a conflict that will not be won with bombs and bullets, but with books and ideas that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity. The thirst for education is palpable, and it is education that will make the difference whether the next generation grows up to be educated patriots or illiterate fighters. The stakes could not be higher. Colonel Christopher Kalenda. These are some Afghan militia commanders who will pretty much reiterate the same thing that Colonel Kalenda or Admiral Mullen would say. If you visit, except me without the beard in the middle there, you see me? Kind of terrified white guy there. Anyways, if you go to their compound, very hospitable, they'll probably go up to the roof, they'll serve you some green tea with a little sprig of mint in it, and then being veterans or mujahideen, they'll start sharing their stories with you. They regret the fact that when they were about 12 years old in 79, they were yanked from their schools when the Soviet Union invaded their country, and they were forced to become militants and to fight the Soviet Union. And most of all, they really regret the fact that they never were able to complete their education. And as you sit there with them, they'll start to point out in the beautiful mountains, the Pamir and Hindu Kush, and then they'll point out where their skirmishes were held. And then they start pointing at particular boulders and stones. And they say, do you see those boulders up there? Every one of those is a Shaheed or martyr who died fighting our enemies, the Taliban or the Russians. Now we must turn those stones into schools and make their sacrifice worthwhile. Even on behalf of the commanders and the militia leaders, they're pleading what they want most is education. In Afghanistan, on Independence Day, which is in August, they have a parade. It's a lot like 4th of July parade, but there's something a little bit unusual because first the widows come, those who've lost their husbands and husbands who've died fighting, and then the orphans come, and then the wounded veterans come in wheelchairs and in crutches hobbling along, and then find the snappy young soldiers come with their weapons. So can you imagine here in the U.S., if we had a 4th of July parade and first our widows came, those who've lost their husbands and wives, who've died fighting in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq. And then the orphans came. And then our wounded veterans came. Today there are 78,000 wounded veterans who've been hurt or maimed in Iraq and Afghanistan in those tragic wars. And then finally, some, you know, an F-16 would do a flyby. And the reason they do that in Afghanistan is they want to honor those who paid the ultimate price. Now, on behalf of all the people, their plea and request is please help us with education. You know, sometimes I hear Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist leaders say something like, God is on our side. And I remember in college we used to get on our knee before a game and say a little prayer. Now, you're asking for good sportsmanship, but really saying, you know, could we just win one more game, win the national championship? Anyways, but you know what? If God is on anybody's side, God is on the side of the widows and the orphans and refugees. And I don't think that anyone here has the right to say God is on our side until every single one of those 120 million children can go to school, until every widow in this world is given hope and shelter, and every orphan is given love. All those wounded veterans are taken. None of us here have the right to say God is on our side, and there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. We're not having question and answer, so I've heard a lot of questions, so I'm going to share with you just a couple thoughts here before we finish up about, you know, everybody wants to know about the deployment of troops to Afghanistan and some other issues. So some of my first concern was that President Obama, the generals, and some of our political leaders, they met, they had 9 meetings, but they met in secrecy. They met behind closed doors. These were secret meetings. The media wasn't involved. And I think, you know, war is the ultimate decision a country can make. It's a moral decision. It's an ethical decision. And it's a financial decision. And I don't think that meetings should be held in secrecy. And I asked a couple senators about this. And he said, well, we're talking about some very, you know, confidential issues, and this is related to national security. But I also happened to know what they were talking about, and it was primarily financial constraints. It cost the U.S. $1 million per troop to deploy to Afghanistan, Iraq. $1 million for 1 year per soldier in those countries. And the other thing is that none of the shura, the elders, were consulted from Afghanistan. You know, if we're trying to determine the fate of a people, they need to be involved in discussion. They should actually be the leaders in that discussion. And I can tell you some other things. The escalation of troops is going to escalate the violence. There are going to be a lot more casualties coming home in coffins to this country. You're going to see it happen very quickly. The other thing is, Vice President Joe Biden and conservative columnist George Will are advocating to pull troops, but their advocacy for this is to replace it with targeted, selected bombings. The one thing that the shura and the elders will all tell you, their number one complaint is, please do not kill civilians with bombs. If there's one way to antagonize a people, it's when you kill civilians. And I can, you know, I've heard dozens and dozens of shura tell you that. So that's not an alternative to replacing troops. Something else that maybe many of you don't know about is that 8 of the 22,000 troops deployed this year, they are trainer troops. These are mostly National Guardsmen, they're reservists, they're dentists, they're engineers, they're accountants, they're nurses, they're doctors, they're businessmen, they're all kinds of things. And they are what I call the brain power, not firepower. And of the 30,000 troops going now to Afghanistan, about 10,000 are going to be trainer troops. So are any of you familiar with that? It's like, okay. Anyways, don't you think we should know about that a little bit? Okay. I'm not trying to get political, but, you know, I think the media and the military and the government should tell us this stuff. And if you ask the shura, you know, what do you really want? They say, yes, we need some brain power, but we do not need firepower. You know, if you don't like somebody or you want to get somebody, we will go capture them or kill them. You don't need to do it yourself. But what we do need is help, and to help rebuild our country. And, you know, we've said we're not into nation building, but, you know, imagine one troop costs $1 million, a Tomahawk cruise missile costs $1 million. You could set up about 30 or 40 schools in that country and provide education for about 20,000 young children with the deployment of one troop to Afghanistan, and the same thing in Pakistan. So, you know, I think that, well, I'm encouraged a little bit that finally this year, last month, Hillary Clinton and Vice President Joe Biden and Holbrooke, they did make a little trip to Pakistan, Afghanistan. They only spent a few hours there. They met with the president, and they met with a few military. Now, if you compare that with our military, our top three military commanders have been in Pakistan, Afghanistan more than 36 times in the last 14 months. And there's a big difference. They've also been meeting with the elders. Admiral Mullen is going to Afghanistan next week. He's going to spend 3 days meeting with the elders and talking to them. Carl Eikenberry, who's our ambassador to Afghanistan, he's an amazing man. He's a retired general, and he's spent, you know, he goes every day to different communities and talks to the shura. And I really think the irony is that I think our military right now is way ahead of our State Department and our political leaders. They really get it. And it's not about change. It's about continuity. We have to have those relationships. And, you know, I'd like to see, you know, 30,000 civilians going over there, but the problem is if you try to recruit them, you're only going to get a few crazy people like me to show up. So in the lieu of that, the U.S. military now has a tremendous and almost impossible responsibility. They have to be a warrior, a diplomat, and humanitarian. It's virtually, I think, impossible. You know, I can't do this and still try and be a warrior and a diplomat. And But it's absolutely imperative that we encourage our government. They have to build relationships and put the elders in charge. And, you know, I can't say enough. I'll just give you an example in a minute. But it's important that we have to start building relationships. And so far, I haven't seen that from our State Department or political leaders. And until that happens, I don't think there's going to be any solution in a country like Afghanistan or Pakistan. Okay. Now we get away from politics. Last year, incidentally, Obama and McCain and Clinton, they contacted me and they wanted political endorsement. So I asked my wife, Tara, you know, what should I do? And she said, Greg, they're all in heat right now. Stay away from them until after elections. So that's what I did. Okay. In 2001, Haji Ali died. Sakina, his wife, died, and it was very sad. I went up to her grave, and then Haji Ali said in a rare moment of sentiment to me, "Without Sakina, I am nothing." And it's very rare to hear a very elderly man say that. And then he said something I never forget. He said, "Soon you'll be standing here, and I'm going to be in the ground." And he kind of chuckled. I didn't think it was very funny because, you know, I lost my father and my sister and everyone here. You've lost somebody dear to you. You never, never get over the loss of a loved one or a friend or colleague. And he said, "When that moment happens, Greg, please do one thing. Listen to the wind." So when I got back to Corfe in October 2001, Haji Ali had passed away. And it was right after 9/11, so I was quite distraught. I walked up to a simple grave, and I thought, how can I go on? This man had become my mentor and surrogate father and told me to sit down and be quiet and drink 3 cups of tea and all those wise lessons. And you know, in his entire life, Haji Ali only left his valley once to go on pilgrimage to Mecca. He had no phone. He had no letters. He had no Twittering or texting or all that stuff. But yet, he knew, and he had the vision to know that through education was a hope for people. And I also thought back to some very precious moments. In the evening, Haji Ali loved to read, but he only read 2 books. He read the Holy Quran, and he read Persian poetry. He had thick goggle glasses. He'd hold the books up close to his eyes. But I often noticed when he read, he was sad, or he'd have a tear in his eye. So one day I asked Haji, "Why are you sad when you read?" He said, "Greg, actually, I don't know how to read, and I memorize these books." And he showed me how every 4th page, he'd flip the page and put little twigs and piece of paper. He said, "It's my life's greatest tragedy that I never learned how to read and write. It's my life's greatest hope that my children and my grandchildren can learn to read and write." And then in his exact words, Haji Ali said, "These words in these books make the stories that make wise the fools." And by fools, he meant illiteracy and ignorance. And this man, again, who never left his village, he knew that through education was a candle and hope for his people. So today, life goes on. We've had our best year ever. We have a board meeting tomorrow, so I guess we'll determine that. But is that right, Abdul, Karen, Chrissy? But we've been able to do that through these relationships the last few years. One goal we established last year is we want to put a girls' high school in Uruzgan province in Afghanistan. Now, this is in the southern areas. It's also the home of Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. And our goal was to do this in 20 years. Well, last year went, and then this year, spring came, we got contacted by the shura, or the elders, from Uruzgan province. And these are these men in black turbans, except me in the middle on the right-hand side. You see without the beard, very terrified white face there. Right, see me? Anyways, they said they want a girls' school in their province, but they wanted to come and visit one of our schools. So this summer, they came to see one of our schools in Char Siam Valley. And when they got to the school, they saw a giant playground. So they put down their weapons, and for the next hour and a half, they went on the swings and slides and had a glorious time. Turbans flying all over. And about an hour and a half later, I said, "You know, let's get serious. We've got to go see the headmaster and look at the curriculum." They said, "No, we're totally satisfied. We want a girls' high school in Uruzgan province." So, but you have to come and have tea and a jirga with us in our home. So I went there this September, and that picture, you know, me, the very terrified, was in their home. And we had a giant, beautiful jirga. They said, "We're going to give free land, entirely free labor. And we are ready to build a girls' high school in Uruzgan, but we do need a playground in the school." So construction started 6 weeks ago, and of course, they're building the playground first. And my only fear is that they might use the playground, and the girls aren't going to get to use it. So got to figure that one out tomorrow in their board meeting. And the other incredible, inspiring thing today, and this is probably closest to my heart next to Corfe School, is 10 years ago I made a promise to some Kyrgyz horsemen who had come over the Wakhan corridor, and they had traveled 6 days on horseback, pretty much, you know, day and night. They were sent as emissaries from Abdul Rashid Khan, who is the commander of the Kyrgyz people. And they met me in a remote area in Charpasin Valley, and They asked me in 99, can you build a girls or a school in our community? We have no help from anybody, government or NGOs. And I made a promise, an oath in 99 to build them a school. Well, it took 10 years to get that school built. And this fall, finally, we were able to build a school. The irony is I've never been to this place. And that's really the narrative arc of Stones into Schools. It was entirely done by the communities on their own initiative and volition. And that's the real, I think, the triumph is the people themselves can be helped. And I never even been there. I want to go there, but I haven't been there yet. George, you've flown over it, I guess. That's what Stones into School is about. Well, I was at a fourth grade class in Houston, Texas, 3 years ago. And these poor kids were trying to read the adult book. So we decided to write a young reader's book and a children's picture book. And in the young reader's edition, you know, I have at home 2,000 emails and criticisms and complaints about Three Cups of Tea. So I actually went through them very carefully. And in this book and Stones into Schools, we have a timeline, a glossary, who's who, more charts, more diagrams, more photos, more this, and 20 pages by my daughter, Mira. And one of the questions asked of Amira is, so what's it like the day your dad goes overseas for several months? What happens? And Amira writes very candidly, well, we wake up, we're kind of sad, then we take daddy to the airport, we cry a bit, but not a ton, and as the day goes on, we get happier, because we know when we get home, daddy will be there because he missed his flight. And that's a true story. Well, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's a lot of decisions that need to be made. But ultimately, we need to live in hope. We cannot live in fear. And fighting terrorism, as I mentioned before, it is based in fear. Promoting peace is based in hope. And the real enemy we all face is ignorance. And, you know, I'm so happy and joyed to be with you today. And my love goes out to all of you. And I'm just... You know, I can't thank you enough, and I'm kind of out of words here, so I'd like to thank you for coming, and I guess that's about it here. Before I close here, I'd like to have George McCown, who's Karen's husband, who's George and Karen have been with me since day one. So, George, could you come up and just say a couple words? Is there steps? Thank you.
Sure. Greg asked me, well, first of all, you can see why Greg has captured the hearts and minds of America. It's not only what he does, it's who he is and the kind of person he is. And I met him in 1995 by complete accident on a trek I was doing to K2, and my life has changed that day. He was building the bridge to build a school over in Corfe. The thing that I wanted to just mention is I was in Afghanistan a few weeks ago, and I had the opportunity to be with Greg's people there, Wakil Karimi and Sarfraz Khan and Wohid Khan. You saw pictures of all them. And I would have to say that the thirst for education on the part of the Afghan people that I was with is absolutely monumental. And they would do almost anything to get an education for their children. And that's both for boys and girls. Secondly, they want us there. They want American help. It's not like we're an occupying force. We are actually, they want more of us, not less of us. And it's very important for us to know what it is we're doing there with these troops that are going out. And I don't think that's been well understood. And Greg alluded to it. But I was... fortunate to spend 2 days with Colonel Kalenda, the right-hand man of McChrystal, the guy that you saw the letter from. And I watched him work with village elders that we had brought in to see him. And it was absolutely amazing. Number one, he listened, and he took notes. I've got some great photographs of this. In the American military compound there, and he heard what they said. And then he said back to them, but you know, for us to help you, you have to do some things too. First of all, you have to get your village elders together with your clerics, and you have to stand up against the Taliban, and you have to tell them you don't want them there. And frankly, if you stand together and you tell them they don't want them there, you don't want them there, they won't come. which is a very interesting thing. As Greg described this tribal culture, that's how it operates. The second thing is that they want education for girls, which is an amazing thing. And the girls and the women will do almost anything to learn to read and write there. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that we have been very successful with a new idea, which is the women's literacy centers, not the girls, but the women themselves. And there's now 25 of those in Kabul. And Wakil Karimi, the man who works for Central Asia Institute, has been putting these, and it's spreading like wildfire all over the country and now over into Pakistan. That's a very, very important point as well. So I guess the message is that it is not an appropriate thing to think about numbers of troops being sent over there. It's really important to ask, what is it they're going to do? And I think that what they have understood, and frankly, Greg has helped them a lot to do this. It's hard to understate the impact he's had on the military mission in that country today. He's helped for them to understand that they have got to listen, they've got to develop respect and relationships, and with that, we've got a very good chance of making a real difference in that part of the world. So with that, Greg, I would like to thank you for all you do and who you are. Thanks.
Thanks, George. Thanks. I'll say one more thing here. Thank you. Thanks. Can I say one more thing? Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. 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 Thank you. I just want to mention one more thing. I forgot to say this. But I learned from Haji Ali and my father and many other elders that we need to listen. And so I ask women in rural Afghanistan or Pakistan, what do you want? You know, we really want to help you, but what do you want? And you'd think most women would tell you they want a good husband, they want prosperity, or they want a big house. But you know what most women tell me are just two simple things. And I think all women here, and especially mothers, you can really relate to this. They tell me, they say, we don't want our babies to die, and we want our children to go to school. And on behalf of all those women, you know, that's their plea and request, and it's simply, we don't want our children to die, and we want them to be able to go to school and have hope for the future. And so if there's any message from all the women there, you know, that's what I'm conveying to you, and that's their hope and request. So again, thank you, and we'll get the tribal chiefess out here to finish up.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed tonight's program, brought to you by Kepler's Bookstore and the Commonwealth Club, Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Greg Mortensen, author of Stones into Schools, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan, our audience here in Los Altos, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting is adjourned.